This is CBSI in the World. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Richard Epstein, who is traveling but kindly agreed to update his comments on the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. We talked of it before the Senate had passed it on to the House and before the House has now endorsed it, and it goes to the president and becomes law. What's important here, Richard tells me, are three elements: the climate element, the pharmaceutical element, and the tax element. Richard, are there any changes from when we first talked of this many days ago that you find significant? We have a few minutes.
Yeah, I don't think there's been any changes in terms of the legal arguments pro or con. I think the most important thing is to recognize that the bill is yet to be signed, let alone go into effect. And already we've seen a gentle moderation of the inflation level and a fairly more dramatic drop in the pricing of energy, of gasoline at the pump. And, you know, this is perfectly consistent with free market sources. As supplies go up and as demand starts to go down, you get into an equilibrium at a small quantity of goods, perhaps, but certainly goods being sold at a lower price. And so you're not going to see the signs of $6 and so forth. It's now down, I guess, about 10 or 12%, depending where you are in the country. And so it seems to me that, you know, here you're trying to control a problem which you can't control through that statute and has already been somebody to moderate. And I don't think it's due to any of the policies that Biden has put into place. And it doesn't change the fact that the best way to deal with the energy crisis is to increase the supply rather than trying to ration through price controls of one form or another. In terms of the tax and the environmental issues, I think, again, it's the danger that we have today with global warming theory is every time we get a hot streak, somebody says it's always attributable to global warming. I have not seen a headline in the Washington Post or the New York Times in some time, which is not contained. And the bad weather we have here made worse by global warming, et cetera, et cetera. It's par for the course. Local events are not what is decisive in understanding global warming. What you have to do is to talk about general temperature trends, and you can't do it week by week. You have to take a somewhat longer trend. And those longer trends show hot spots in some places and cooler spots in other places. It may well be that there's a slight upward trend. That is, itself has been argued, but let's assume for the sake of argument it is. But it's not clear, A, how rapid the trend is, and B, it is very doubtful as to how much temperature change you can make by unilateral actions in the United States at a time when both India and China are making rapid expansions in their use of fossil fuels. So it could be you're spending hundreds of billions of dollars, and maybe in 20 years it will reduce the temperature that we have by a hundredth of a degree centigrade. You have to be able to answer those questions. And what is so striking about the debate is that quantitative estimates with any credibility have not been put forward by the defenders of the particular bill. On the pharmaceutical side, I think the simplest point to say, you don't encourage innovation by having price controls. The United States is an aging population. Things like Alzheimer's diseases and various forms of dementia and all sorts of complications associated with the geriatric dimension are very expensive to deal with. And if what you do is you essentially put price caps on the sale of new drugs, nobody's going to put them forward because they'll never be able to recover not only the fixed cost associated with the particular drug, but the fixed cost associated with all the drugs that never get past the experimental state. And you have to recover all the losses from your losers through your winners. And there doesn't seem to be very much consistent evidence about how to do that. It's also the case that if you look at the increasing product in pharmaceutical prices, particularly relative to inflation, it has abated somewhat in the last several years. They're not nearly as enormous as they were before. So it may well be that competitive forces are really working rather well here. So if that's the case, again, what you want to do is to protect patents on innovation, which I think are clearly needed with respect to most of these drugs, and to reduce the regulatory obstacles of getting them through. The FDA is always highly controversial, particularly in the age of COVID. You don't know whether it's going to move too fast or too slow. But traditionally, with respect to drugs of this sort, it has been much too cautious about letting them into the market. And by slowing things up, it has essentially compromised the health of large numbers of American citizens. And the simplest measure of that is ask how many lives you could have saved in year one by a drug that was proposed in year young but was only approved in year 10 or year 5. And you've lost all the interim use from these good drugs. bad drugs getting on the market more quickly wash out because they don't work and people will not start to take it. So I think all three components of this are questionable. The actual mechanics of these bills remains to be seen. The point you always have to make is whoever controls the drafting of the regulations can determine in great detail exactly what will happen. So if you turn out to get a Democratic administration in 2024, it will intensify. You get a Republican administration, it will ease up. If Congress is Republican, it will mean that if you need supplemental legislation, the defenders of this bill will not be able to get it. And it's quite likely that the efforts of every generation of legislatures to control the world for the next 10 or 15 years will be frustrated by the next generation of elected officials who say, we can't be bound by your ukases. This is a very disturbing trend in the United States in which people are constantly saying, well, we're going to make policy decisions today that will determine the level of global warming or pharmaceutical production or taxes in 2050. Forgetting that you've got another 28 years and some other people in the interim may want to have something to say about this as well. So I don't like this kind of long-term planning. The kind of planning I like is one which says, look, here's a problem. Let's see what we can start to do, making tentative changes and then adjusting back and forth. I don't believe in the apocalypse stories about anything, including global warming. The data itself are just not that unilaterally clear. Things go up, things go down. There are multiple factors that are involved in that case. And so the effort to make once and for all decisions by the Biden administration, I think, is a combination of hubris on the one hand and ignorance on the other.
For me, reading about the tax piece of the bill is to impose a 1% excise tax on stock buybacks for $74 billion. Why? What is the prejudice against stock buybacks?
They basically believe that it's a sign of corporations basically pandering to rich people. What it is a complete misconception of what's going on. A buyback means that the current corporation doesn't have particularly good use for the money. If it buys back stock, well, what you then do is you produce a capital gain for the recipient, and they can take the money and invest it in something else. So what happens is most people think if you have a buyback, there's going to be an orgy of consumption, whereas in fact what it means is that people who know how to handle money will make venture capital investments in smaller firms, which are likely to be more productive than the incremental changes that people with large firms can do.
Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution commenting on the bill headed to the president's desk, Inflation Reduction Act. Bill, become an act. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.